So, now we have the opportunity for questions and answers. And there can be questions about the talk I've given, or even other questions. Yes, we have a question about that. Okay, saying thanks for the teachings, I can see they change people's lives. Please, for the better or for the worse? For the better, yeah.
So we have a background both in science and meditation, which I consider a sort of scientific approach to spirituality. So is there any insight that you got from science or any methodology that you recognize that you can use in meditation?
Okay. I think hopefully you've heard the beginning of that question. One of the reasons why I repeat questions is because sometimes the people don't hear it, and it is live stream, it is recorded. Are there any differences between any insights from science which you can give for meditation? One thing is that scientists are very unscientific. Unfortunately, just like any other profession, they have vested interests and trying to keep your reputation. And sometimes the scientists should be challenged more. Peer pressure is great, but what does peer pressure mean? Also, peer review, they call it, peer review. Peer review, when you get other people in the same field judging you. You need people who are outside of that field. Imagine if you had the government doing a peer review of their policies. So say the Tory government, so there are policies right and wrong. Are we corrupt? And they get other Tory ministers to investigate you. Obviously, any review has to be independent. So with science, but it's great because it allows you to break new ground. So, this is one of those things, I think I might have said this last time I was here, but it's something which always challenged me. Beginnings and ends. You know what it's like, many sort of religions believe in the Creator God. A beginning of time. And I'm saying on the way here, or earlier on, that just having a sort of connection with Stephen Hawking. He was the one who, from Roger Penrose's black holes, turned it the other way around in time. The black holes are a finality, once it's a black hole, it's the end of things. And why can't sort of a big bang, the opposite of a black hole, be the origins of time? So he's got the big bang theory, which most people just do not understand at all. Because there are things before the big bang, just as there are things after the black hole. Hawking radiation turned the idea of a black hole being a beginning upside down. So, how did things start? Number one, there's two parts to this answer. Number one, just allowing for stillness to see things in a different way. There's one fundamental law of science, which I don't think anyone can doubt, for the conservation of mass energy. Mass and energy. Mass can change into energy, which is as nuclear bombs. But also, the sum total of mass and energy can neither be created or destroyed. So, how could this world come from nothing? And of course, the answer should be pretty obvious. There is something in this universe which we do call negative energy. And a good example of that is what you heard in your high school, potential energy. If you have this bottle of water, because it's in the gravitational field, actually to send this bottle of water to outer space, in other words, free from the Earth's gravitational field, takes energy. Some amount of energy in this water has to be sacrificed to send you to outer space. It's called a negative energy. Any mass in any field has a negative energy component. So the whole universe, as we know it, as a whole, you add up the positive energies and the negative energies. What would happen if those energies totally cancelled out? If every part of the universe could come together, we draw together, would it be like a huge ball of power? In other words, still lots of positive energy. Or would it totally cancel each other out? And because I've got a science background, I'm also a Buddhist monk, and I get invited to interesting conferences. And this one was at our local university, where the physicist and the scientist of the year in Australia at the time, David Blair. And I mean, I mentioned that to him in public. He turned around to me and said, "Ajahn Brahm, you're so up to date. Omega equals one." I didn't know what omega meant, but that actually meant the balance of mass energy in this world. So the truth of the matter is, if everything came together, it wouldn't be an immense born of ultimate energy, not a God. A divine being comes together and totally cancels out, becomes nothing. Zero, emptiness, nothing left. Why does it come from nothing? Because, and even great scientists have mentioned this, it's actually part of Hawking radiation. Why does the universe happen anyway? There's some law which is even more fundamental than any law of physics called Murphy's Law. I don't know who Murphy was, but he deserves, or she deserves, a Nobel Prize. In other words, if it can happen, it does happen. That's actually almost fundamental part of quantum physics. Probability, if it can, it will. If the universe can happen, it will happen. All from nothing. And anyway, that's why I'm a cheeky monk sometimes. On one visit, I think I was going to Singapore. Again, I have friends from different religions. And this friend thought it was about right time to convert me. He said, "Ajahn Brahm, you have to admit that nothing is higher than God." I said, "Yes, I admit that. I agree with you. Nothing, emptiness, nirvana, is much higher than God." He said, "I didn't mean that." He said, "I didn't mean that. Nothing, emptiness, anything." So anyway, that was one of the things which I love about Buddhism. That's what Ajahn Chah would always tell me. There's nothing. Emptiness. Anyway, the other one is the origins of the world. Is there an origin to this world, a beginning? How can there be? Because then what's before the beginning? So instead, I use this analogy about planet Earth. Many centuries ago, people thought this Earth was flat. If you sailed in the most amazing contraptions, high technology boats which had sails for other people rowing them, if you sail fast enough, you'll fall off the edge of the world. But after a while, we all know that planet Earth is a sphere. It has no edges to it, no boundaries. But it's got a limited area, as we all know, because we've struggling for land, for water, for resources, one of the causes of the environmental crisis. But it's got a limited area, but no edges or boundaries to it. And then the next thing, space, the universe. And any person who's done any sort of science, astrophysics, knows this universe, with all its galaxies, the clusters of galaxies, this universe has got limited volume. It's only a certain size. If anybody is in such a beautiful, simple truth, it's called Obelus paradox. Remember that in science, you can't have an infinite number of stars in this universe. But anyway, that's another sort of little argument you can look at later on. But even science knows this thing we call our universe, limited volume, but no edges to it. Why? Just like this planet Earth, it's curved. It's not flat, it's not a flat universe. It's a curved universe. So, whichever way you go from this Temus Bullis Vihara, you go this way, that way, whichever way, you go far enough, you end right back here. You are the center of the universe. And every other place is the center of the universe. Just like on planet Earth. In Colombo, whichever way you go, and if you keep going, you come back to Colombo. You're in Perth, Australia, whichever way you go, you come back. It's a circle, it's round. So that's the universe. That's accepted. So let's go to the next level. Time. And I predict many years, decades, centuries from now, people look back upon our early civilizations and call them flat time Earths, like flat Earthers, believing that time is flat, with edges to it, beginnings and ends, instead of round time, curved time, with no beginnings and no ends. Just like anything else in this universe. All is round. And that understands no beginnings, no ends, no edges to this universe, no beginnings or ends of this planet Earth. Circle around. Answer some fundamental questions about beginnings and ends. And so, anyone, that is beautiful. That doesn't have these psychological problems of needing some sort of divine being outside of the laws of science to start things off and end things. Anyway, that's why everyone thinks the same, no one thinks at all. From stillness to peace, you have amazing insights. Different ways of looking at things. Okay, there's another question in the back somewhere. Quite a few questions now. Yeah.
Hello. Venerable sir.
Yeah.
If I understood correctly or if I speak to you, I think you said in the mindful meditation, when leads to stillness of the mind, the peace of the mind, and that evokes the creativity center of the brain.
Yeah.
And that leads to and to know if there's been any scientific done on this.
Okay. Scientific studies on the stillness.
Yeah, and the connecting to the mindfulness meditation, the stillness which leads to the center of the creativity center of the brain being activated, and so like the chemical changes that would result in that, is there any scientific
Again, it's very difficult to have a study in this because there's no money to be made in such studies. If you have a study in mindfulness which allows your business to become more productive, of course. You know that modern science depends upon grants. And grants that are usually sponsored, you know, by, unfortunately, corporations. So many scientists have to get some money to do their research. And the things which don't have like a financial outcome, then it's very hard to get funding. I'm being quite honest. Which is one of the reasons why that in old days, you know, when I went to a place like Cambridge, we had an ethos that for education, for research's sake, and to explore the limits of knowledge, and not really looking for the financial benefits in it. To send people like me to Cambridge, and my father was already passed away, dead. My mother was just, she was just a typist, a typing fool, before she upgraded to being a secretary. She couldn't afford living in a council flat. Now, we were legitimately poor. My friends at primary school were all migrants. And the reason was because we were living in a poor area. And so we were poor, but if you had the abilities, the government would actually give you scholarship after scholarship, because they realized that it didn't matter about elite, where your family came from, it's your abilities gave you that opportunity, those openings. And the same with research. Research done for its own sake. And to this day I remember the old Cavendish Laboratory, sort of, you know, in Cambridge. And there you're given this tour around the place. It had these old annexes and corridors and places where these crazy old scientists have been doing stuff for years. And, you know, like the mad scientists, they were there. And the point was, they would sponsor, they would make sure they had a home and got, you know, all opportunity to do their research. 100 projects would come to nothing. But one success would change the world. In other words, they were always looking for rewards in finances, but in pushing the boundaries of knowledge further, just because the pursuit of knowledge, the pursuit of truth, was more important than the pursuit of economic prosperity. But how many colleges, universities, even schools now, just seek, they need the dollar, the pound, because they cannot afford to survive otherwise. It's academic integrity, academic freedom is in great danger. Unfortunately, even in a great country like UK, you try and get funding for such research. Now, who would actually sponsor that? What corporation? The creativity. That's why sometimes it's hard when you teach it in temples, you teach it in other places. Where's the research? It's hard to find. I think there's some around, but very few of arbitrary. Okay, so there's many in the back. Some over there as well, maybe over there. Yeah. So maybe over here first of all, then. Maybe over there is a bit out of the way.
First of all, thank you very much for being here, for your talk. I have a clarification from you, and also a question. The clarification is about caring being better than curing. I cannot get it, because for me I think that if you manage to cure, it's much better than caring. But according to you, it's always better to be caring than curing. So I would like, you know, if you could actually explain that.
Yes.
And the second thing is, the former Prime Minister, Theresa May, appointed a minister to deal with loneliness in this country, because it's becoming a major mental health issue. What would you advise the government to do to cope with loneliness?
Okay. So first of all, curing and caring. It's not a one or the other. If your main goal is to cure somebody, is that sometimes all costs and you don't end up killing people at all. You make it worse. A good example of that is a little exercise which I did at, it was in Hong Kong at Queen Elizabeth Medical Center over there, which to make a good point about end of life care. So had people pairing off, you know, A, B, A, B, all the A's, please get together. And B's, now the A's, I want you to imagine when I ring the gong, you have a heart attack, cardiac arrest. You may have seen it on the TV, you may have personally experienced one or see someone else experience one, so you've got to act that out when I ring the gong. You B's, primary care is the first person who gets on the scene. Okay? And then the A's and the B's, and I ring the gong, and people, you know, bad actors, but they try their very best, have a heart attack, fall to the ground, and the other person, B, come on, the ambulance is coming quickly, stay with me, keep your eyes open, it's okay, it's going to be fine. And then afterwards, a debriefing, what was it like? And the B's, the A's, who, it was so intrusive. And I was having my heart attack, and it gave me more stress. That all you're trying to keep me alive at all costs. Okay, turn it around. The A's. Now the first care was the B's have a heart attack. And the B's couldn't have a heart attack. And the A's were just far more relaxed. Oh, it's okay. Even their voice was not so fast, was not without so much panic. Their response was far more caring. And the result is, it's not that the cure rate goes down, the curing rate goes up. Because the panic to cure at all costs causes stress instead of caring, which actually creates tangible health benefits. I don't know what it's like these days in the national health system. Do nurses have time to care for patients? Do they have time to just sit by them, hold their hand, and just talk about the problems? Has that got a positive health outcome? To care creates higher curing rates. If you put curing first, you find the care is not there. That's where it comes from. And other things, like, you know, you may have a husband who's giving you a hard time. Don't try and cure him with bad habits. Care for him, and then the bad habits cure by themselves. Come from care. Addiction. A lot of times people say the reason they're addicted is because they feel terrible about themselves. And you stigmatize them, and the cure rate goes down, they get worse. Care for them. Well, a lot of times people have addictions. They're running away from feeling they're not worthy, they've been abused, traumatized, and now, bad person, you're addicted. Caring rather than curing. Loneliness? Not careful. And a lot of times that it is because we're far too busy. Far too busy to visit our loved ones. Interesting thing which Singapore did, that they gave people like a tax credit if they live within 1 kilometre of their parents. So it's financially important to be close enough to your parents so you can look after them. How many of us live the other side of London, the other side of our world? To our mum and dad. So we can't go and visit you. Imagine that you got a financial benefit of living so close to your parents. Of course, you'd be able to visit them much more. Loneliness. Who are the lonely people in this world? Rejected. A lot of times it's elderly people. And you've got children. kids and their grandparents or kids and elderly people they've never known before. They get on so well. And they just lighten each other up. So you see every now and again programs of kids, elderly people coming together and they bond. Have a kid in your life, a little kid, maybe a grandchild or something. Unfortunately, that these days, child abuse, parent abuse, I don't know what, to try and protect, we actually create so much problems in our life. Of course you've got to protect kids, but even now, sort of, carelessness of a kid happened to me in this temple. I was a school teacher for 1 year, and sometimes some of the kids would come out and they'd just give you a big hug. Not sexual abuse anymore, but now teachers are afraid of even touching their kid. And unfortunately that means kids would become lonely at school. To the parents, they're actually causing harm sometimes. So anyway, if you are lonely, you're not lonely. There's so many people in this world. One of the wonderful things as a monk, as a nun, we're very lonely in the sense that, you know, we spend months and years by ourselves. But when I was by myself doing a long retreat some years ago, I was never lonely. I was always with my best friend, me. So simple loneliness. These days as a monk, you know, as a monk you can't hug people. Because people get the wrong idea. But I've got a way around that.
I can feel the endorphins coming through my body.
And number one, I cannot be accused of sexual abuse by hugging myself. Number two, I can't contract a disease I don't already have. I'm not a selfish, but I do have a disease. It is contagious. Hepatitis B. Did you hear that correctly? Not hepatitis B, that's dangerous. Hepatitis Buddhism. Hepatitis B. But sometimes I do get very careful because I travel around a lot. And last time I was travelling, I had some virus, some cough. I called it terminal illness. I got it from going through terminals. Terminal 2, Queen's Terminal, Terminal 3, Terminal 1. Too much travelling through airport terminals, you get terminal illness. Okay, come on. We'll answer some more questions. Okay, over there. I think you're next here.
Hello, welcome back to London, Ajahn.
Yeah.
A wise monk once said, "Oh, knowledge is just a signpost. It's the only direction that's not the real thing." I wondered if you'd like to put that into context for me.
Exactly. For example, I was visiting our Bhikkhuni monastery in Perth. Really successful Bhikkhuni monasteries. So we're exporting that tradition, which was there in the beginning of Buddhism. That's why any funds raised today, with the permission of the head monk, who's a really good monk, very supportive, and the treasurer, goes to the Anicca Bhikkhuni project. Even in the time of the Buddha said, "Nuns can't buy things with difficulty." That's even the Buddha said that. So they want to make sure that they have equity. Come on, just. This is actually required even by law now. There's no reason why not. So we're making more and more bhikkhunis. That's my job. I've got bhikkhuni factory over here. I'm going to get a franchise bhikkhuni factory. But no, so I was at the Nuns Monastery and they said, "You just came for a visit, can you please give us a teaching?" I said, "Okay, well, I'll give a quick teaching." So I need to use the toilet. Where's the toilet? I built most of that monastery, that part anyway. And they said, over there. So where? So you see, it's the sign on there. Men's toilet. So I went to the door and I just pretended. I didn't do it, I just pretended to urinate on the door. What are you doing, you crazy mug? I said, it says there, men's toilet. I just followed the sign. And I said, no, that's inside. Why don't you put that on the sign? Men's toilet inside. And then it's there on the door. So that's why the signpost is not the destination. When you see the signpost, female toilet, that's not the toilet. It's inside. I was just to emphasize a point. The signpost, the words. Peace. What does that mean? Give a demonstration now. Okay, and close your eyes, just a couple of minutes. Don't need to change your posture. Peace. 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 And that's enough, open your eyes. Whenever you say the word, it's a signpost. I kept on repeating it, your mind actually went a little way towards peace. Say it again, it goes again towards peace. And many of you could feel that. This is why you didn't want to open your eyes. We're experiencing peace. The words were then to direct the mind. If you don't give the words time to show their meaning, we have another work coming afterwards. How can you ever expect to know peace? Just know the words. So because we're too rushed. One thought after another thought after another thought, incessantly, without having the peace, the stillness in between, to let the previous word show its destination. Does that make sense? Good. Okay. At the back, please let us know when it's time to finish off, because this is not my vihara, so I don't want to offend the temple management or the monks who work very hard. So I want to be invited back next time. Yes, please.
Yes, we are extremely grateful to have you here, and it is an honor and a privilege, I think, to have you here. And I think, this, if I remember rightly, this is your fourth visit to this temple. And thank you very much for selecting our humble Vinagra to launch your 2019 tour of England. Thank you very much for coming and giving useful advice for people who are interested in meditation. I know that you are not very happy with flattery. This is not flattery at all. This is real truth. You are now so highly regarded throughout the whole world that you are now second to only one other, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, as far as we are concerned. So that is the truth. And my question is, ever since I read the Dependent Origination maybe 10, 15 years ago, I was under the impression that birth, death and rebirth are just processes. They're nothing substantial at its core. And I base that conclusion on the fact that Buddha never mentioned any life in dependent origination. He said, dependent on consciousness, name and form arises, which means there is no life whatsoever mentioned in dependent origination, which I consider to be the greatest advice or contribution to humanity. And are you in agreement with me that absolutely there is nothing but only processes in birth, death and rebirth? Thank you.
Of course, a very deep question. It's true what you say, that the Buddha said that anyone who sees dependent origination sees the Dharma, anyone who sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. So it's one of his wonderful teachings, often misunderstood, but the idea of a process is wonderful, because that's in the Kacchanagota Sutra in the Samyutta Nikaya, and that is where the Buddha said, you can't say there's nothing at all, that everything is just nothing here, because you have your experience. The experience arises. You're hearing me now, you're seeing me. You can't say there is something, because things fade away almost immediately. So it's the in-between. What the Buddha said was another description of the middle way, which is dependent origination. One thing leads to another. It's a process. Not a being controlling us, but even the name and form, which you say, is from division, arises the karma formations, otherwise known as your idea of being in control of this process, the will. The will is Chaitanya, and that creates consciousness. You're here because your will made you come here. But is it really your will? There is what I call the simile of the driverless bus. This is a simile which I developed a long time before Google got the idea. And I realized I should have really instructed many temples around the world to be able to patent the idea of the driverless bus. But anyway, I'm not a business muck. So instead, the driverless bus simile is sometimes we come to a temple to improve our lives, thinking that sometimes our will is stupid. It's like you're in a bus journey, and sometimes your bus goes through terrible toxic waste dumps of life. You look out the window and it's disgusting what you see. So what do you want to do? You want to tell your bus driver to put on the accelerator, get out of here as soon as possible. Now you have the cancers, the divorces, the tragedies in life. You don't want it to last. Get out of here as soon as you can. What does your bus driver do? Slows down and stops. So difficulties and pains, tragedies last longer than you think they should. Now life is going well for you. Have a wonderful time, great relationship, good kids, financial security, everything is going so well. What happens? You say, tell the bus driver, slow down, let's enjoy this as long as we can. Go into the beautiful scenery of life. What does your bus driver do? Speeds up. So the good times, the happy times, don't last as long as you think they should. Tragedies last too long. And the bus driver, your will. Come on, make better choices in life. What happens? You've got to find where the bus driver sits, first of all. Be able to tell the bus driver how to drive the bus. Your life. Yeah. To try and train your will to do better. And what happens next is you finally find out where the bus driver sits. You only can do that through deep meditation. Come face to face with this thing which you understand as a will. And you find that bus driver's seat is empty. No one there. Anatta, non-self. To the point that you realize says the cause and effect condition process. And then you go back to your seat and you start complaining. There's no one to complain to. The end of desire and ill will. It's a little story. But sometimes to be able to teach, you've got to develop anecdotes, stories, and adapt them to what the Buddha said. So that's the driver's bus simile. Why did you come to this temple today? Was it your own free will? It appears that way, doesn't it? Will you go and look at some of these research done by Professor Libet, John Libet, The Nation of the Will? Or one of the other things which I saw with my own eyes at the Cambridge Psychic Research Society, another hypnotism experiment. They asked many students to be hypnotized. I volunteered, but I was not a good subject in those days. And as a student, you didn't do anything. You know, just for, you know, experiment, courage. You didn't have a reputation to lose. So one of the students went up there, was easy to hypnotize, and the hypnotist said in front of the whole audience to this man under hypnosis, "When I touch my left ear lobe, you will stand up, no matter what's going on, and sing the British National Anthem in a loud voice." And, you know, well, I was interested in this. Well, what happened? He gave the post-hypnotic suggestion, you won't remember this command, but when I touch my left ear, you will sing the British National Anthem. And during the lecture, at one of the most unimportant times, the hypnotist touches left ear. And this student stood up, I saw it, stood up and sang, "God save the Queen," right from beginning to end, in a loud voice. Being students, we were howling with laughter, jeering at him. It didn't stop him at all. He went from beginning to end in a loud voice. We were still laughing when the hypnotist calmed us down and asked the student, "Why did you do that? Why did you sing the British National Anthem in the most inappropriate time?" And this student gave a reason for it. And that shocked me, and shocked many others. This student was of the clear perception that he freely chose, for a good reason, to sing the British National Anthem. When we all knew, we saw it, it was conditioned by the hypnotist. And from that I got very scared. How much of my choices were mine? And how much of them were conditioned by society, by my parents, by my teachers? How much of it was mine and how much of it wasn't? And now, you know that you may disagree with this, but this is what happens. None of it is mine. Condition process. One of those conditions is hearing the Dhamma from a good teacher. I was conditioned by Ajahn Chah. He was conditioned by his teachers. He goes right back to the Buddha. Reprogram my mind. Who reprogrammed Buddha Gautama's mind? Buddha Kassapa. That's in the Gatikara Sutta. You can see the Buddha was there with Buddha Kassapa, the monk Gotipala. Anyway, interesting stuff. But that's deep Dharma. Sometimes when I talk about the will, people get scared, right? In Singapore, the head of the group which I was teaching at the time was a top lawyer. And he said one day, "Can you please give us a deep talk?" And I'll defend the originator. "Really, go for it." I said, "Okay." So I gave this really deep talk on the nature of the will, dependent origination, dependent of consciousness is what they are. And the following morning he picked me up to take me to breakfast. He said, "Please never do that again." I couldn't sleep at night. All night was up. He knew it was true, but he didn't want to accept it. So be careful. Sometimes teaching too deep. Sometimes people aren't ready for it. Understood. Anyway, next question. Is there a question? Almost time, I think.
No, I was wondering if you could give any advice on how to be a good teacher and take that, like how to deal with frustration.
How frustration? Frustration only happens because you have too high expectations. So please lower your expectations, and then you'll never be frustrated. And every success would happen because you're so pleased. Wow, it worked.
Yay.
So lower expectations, because I'm passing high expectations. And to do this physically, an executive over in Australia, she said, she described this like physically. She said, this is where I know I should be in my life. This is where I am. I try to improve myself, but I get so frustrated because I just can't get up there. For various reasons, glass ceilings, people don't appreciate it, vested interests, patriarchies, whatever. I know I should be up here, but I just can't get up here. And I get so frustrated. I said, how can I solve that problem? So very simple, this is where you are, this is where you want to be. How about knowing where you want to be to where you are? Then you're content. Not frustrated anymore. Oh, we're very frustrated. We're really hard trying to do many, many things. Some succeed, some don't succeed. Can I get frustrated? No. I don't expect much in life. When you don't expect much in life, you get so much more. Lower your expectations. How many parents here, how many parents think your child is above average intelligence? If you're honest, you think they all are. But only half your children can be above average. That's what average means. But we don't admit it. No, my kid is above average intelligence. So if your kid at school comes in the top 10% or the bottom 10%, you are very bad Buddhist parents. Why do I say that? Because you're Buddhist, you believe in the middle way. So if your kid comes in the middle somewhere, marvellous Buddhist parents. Avoid extremes. But of course, if you have that emotional intelligence, your kids usually do really well. Without pressure. They grow fast. There's lots of pressure, they get stunted. Middle way is the best. Okay, that way you avoid frustration. And the poor kids never realize, never understand from a very young age, they don't need to achieve to be loved. They don't feel good about themselves. The old emotional intelligence, Daniel Goleman, who was a Buddhist, understood that too many people strive for excellence and only get frustrated and depressed. Instead of learning how to be happy with themselves, content with themselves. And that's when they start to excel in life. Even business. People keep on telling them, top business people are not the ones who get degrees from universities. Who are they who got left university? It was obviously Bill Gates left university, Steve Jobs left university, never sort of finished university. Who else? Michael Dell left university. Who else? Of course, Mark Zuckerberg didn't finish university. And they're all multi-billionaires. So if your kid drops out of university, wow, you can be the parents of a multi-billionaire kid, you don't have to work, you can retire young. Oh. It doesn't mean you have to do that, but sometimes there's something else in life which we miss. So education, you get frustrated. It's competition with I never liked that, even as a kid. Sometimes in an exam, sitting next to my best friend, and I could help them. But the teacher called that cheating. I call that cooperation. And in life, real life, you get anywhere to competing with people? Without cooperating. So learn cooperation by allowing cheating at school. At least some form of helping one another, because that's life. And then you don't feel lonely anymore. You're part of things. Okay. So anyway, when everyone thinks the same, no one thinks at all. So the last thing is whatever I've said, please don't believe it. If you think about that question, it just confuses you. Because if you follow that question, don't believe me, then actually you believe what I said. And if you do believe me, again, you're against what I advise you. So it's an advice which can never be kept. As I heard once from a Zen master. Before they left, they wanted one last piece of advice. And the master told the student, never argue with an idiot. And the disciple said, that's not compassionate. The master said, yes, I agree with you. Okay, that I will leave the talk finished for the day. So, summing up, is anyone going to come on? Okay. Okay, there's books and stuff. A donation box. So those of you having difficulty in life, sometimes because you haven't made enough good karma. So if you want to increase your karma, we don't have donation box, we have a letting go box. Letting go box is outside. So, is that here? Where is it? I don't know. Oh, books and stuff. Oh, where are they? I can't see books. Okay, it's just behind. On the table there's books. Okay. Start the project, bikini project, and a couple of bikini projects. Have you got some time to make a few words? Is that okay? Okay, you can do it. Okay. Okay.
Most Venerable Mahasangha, Most Venerable Ajahn Brahm, and the Bhikkhuni, Most Venerable Bhikkhuni, dear devotees, dear friends, ladies and gentlemen, children. We have listened to a very important speech. It's coming up to about maybe 1.5 hours or 2 hours, but very knowledgeable. We learned a lot tonight. And Ajahn Brahm needs no introduction to all of you, most of you. He is an iconic figure universally. So, on behalf of the Saints Buddhist Vihara, as well as our venerable resident monks and the members of the congregation and those who, all of you are here, I offer my sincere thanks to you, sir, for delivering this speech tonight. And I thank all of you for attending today. And I hope Ajahn will come again in the future for similar talks and speeches and sermons. And I wish you good health and happiness and a bright future. Thank you all very much.
There are books over there, so I can actually sign them if you need them to be signed. Could you please just wait for one moment more, because Father Hamdra did invite me to talk about the Bhikkhuni project. So the Bhikkhuni project, England has only got one Bhikkhuni at the moment. She's sitting right next to me. So if you wish to see more women fully ordained, as in the time of the Buddha, please show your support with the supporting Bhikkhuni Chanda, and also join in the Anukampa Bhikkhuni Project website. I'm sure you can find that out somewhere on the table. Many people will be able to tell you about it. Okay. So especially the females here, just please badger your husband to join in supporting the Bhikkhuni Project.
Keep it like this.